I'm Steve Potter. This is Cityscape, and here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon Newsroom are following today. The chairman of Missouri's Legislative Black Caucus is stepping down. Local Senator Jamila Nasheed, a Democrat, said her resignation comes as many in the group were upset by her recent appearance with Republican Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon is creating a new military partnership led by State Treasurer Clint Zifel. The partnership will focus on keeping and enhancing the state's defense installations. Similar efforts are already underway in the Metro East concerning Scott Air Force Base. And Metropolitan St. Louis Sewer District officials are keeping a watchful eye on today's weather. They're concerned about the rain and melting snow combining to cause possible flooding. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. And by the way, we just heard from William Stage, whose book, Fading Ads in St. Louis. And if you have photos of fading ads, you can post them on our Facebook page, St. Louis Public Radio Facebook page. Right now we have one from a listener who took a picture of a fading ad in the Carondelet neighborhood. So if you have some, share them with us on Facebook. The Midnight Company's production of the St. Louis premiere of Rick Crease's Solemn Mockeries is up and running at Tower Grove Abbey. Midnight's artistic director, Joe Hanrahan, plays William Henry Ireland and all the other characters in this true story of a Shakespeare forger. Welcome, Joe Hanrahan.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
This is a new work. It was first produced in Los Angeles last February. And the fact that it tells a true story is intriguing because the fraud is so fantastic.
Indeed. Just in order to impress his father, William Henry, as a teenager, began forging Shakespeare's signature. That's all his father had ever desired in his life. But he went on to produce business papers, poems. He rewrote King Lear. And in a final act of pride, overweening pride, he wrote a new Shakespeare play, which London swept up and decided to produce at the finest theater in London.
Now, reading about this, I want you to explain this to me. Reading about it, you know, often they say based on a true story, but I noticed that this is billed as a true story. So are we to assume that these facts are pretty much the way it was?
Yeah, they're well documented, and the playwright has insisted that everything in this play, except for one character's name that had a dual name with another character that he changed. Everything in it is true. There's a lot of quotes from a lot of their public documents and statements, as well as every incident in the play.
You say this play is a sad story and hilarious.
It is hilarious. It is the William Henry's take on it. The play actually takes place in 1825. He's come back from exile to England on a speaking tour to explain himself, kind of apologize, but also take credit for it.
Right, because this is when he was older and was actually in the late 1700s when he was a teenager that he committed the fraud?
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, so he's come back to explain it and his take on things and the characters he ran into, the theater scene, the royalty, his father's take on it is very funny, but it's also very sad because it's a son who wanted nothing more than his father to recognize him, and he never achieved that, and it's heartbreaking in a way.
Let's talk a little bit about the backstory there. So this is the story. Your character is William Henry Ireland, and he grows up, how can I put it, with a lack of positive feedback.
Exactly. No one thought he had anything on the ball. His school said he was so stupid that you should take him out or you're wasting your money. His father didn't call him William Henry. He called him Sam after the name of his dead twin brother who died at childbirth. And he called him that throughout his life.
That's child abuse, isn't it?
And then as a teenager, his father kind of exiled him. He said, you have to go into a profession now, so you are articled to a conveyancer in chancery, which meant spending 60 years writing and rewriting contracts for the conveyance of property in a windowless room for 60 years. You know?
Wow. So evidently at some point, maybe it was numerous times, he'd heard his father loved Shakespeare. And he'd heard his father say over and over that he just wished he had – if he only had like – I don't know. Was it a Shakespeare autograph or something?
That's what he wanted because no one knows if there is one or has an authentic one. His father collected all kind of memorabilia from Henry VIII and Charles I and the Lord of Southampton and all kind of folks, everything you can imagine, souvenirs and purses and banners. But his son really – William Henry really learned about his father's dedication to obtaining a Shakespeare signature on a trip to Stratford-upon-Avon where where his father bought all kind of bogus materials, information and stuff that people fawned off on him as property and things that had touched Shakespeare. And it was right there that William Henry vowed, I'm going to be the one to provide this to him and become his hero.
So this play, Solemn Mockeries, has only been produced for less than a year. Did you have a chance to see it?
No, I didn't. It was produced in L.A. in the spring, and then they actually did one performance this fall at the United Solo Theater Festival, a three-week festival of solo shows in New York, and it was a big hit there as well as L.A. I've been able to talk to the playwright extensively.
I was going to ask if you'd met the playwright or know him.
Yeah, I've met him. We've talked to him. He's worked with us, and actually he is in town this weekend to see the production.
Really? Tell me a little bit about Rick Kreese.
Rick Kreese is a teacher at UCLA of writing programs. He's been a member of the board for the Independent Shakespeare Company out there. He's written one play for him. He's writing another. And he's got a couple of other writing projects up his sleeve. He's produced a documentary on a Civil War story that I know he's developing further.
That was on PBS, I think.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, it was.
Okay. Well, you know, if you didn't know this was a true story, you wouldn't think it was because it's so outrageous, and I'd never heard of this. So am I in the minority here?
No, I don't think you are. I think it's a small story. There was a book a couple years ago, The Boy Who Would Be Shakespeare, that did get some attention, and there's been other writings on it, and scholars know, of course, of his works, and his plays and other documents still exist, and you know, in that kind of specialized area. But no, I mean, I think you have to really kind of seek this out, and luckily Rick Kreese has written it and you know produced a script for us to find out about this charming and funny story.
Well, so we have this teenager, William Henry Ireland, who is made out to be a loser by everyone he should be respecting, right? And so to please his father, he wants to create Shakespeare's signature. That's where it begins, right?
It begins. The first piece was a mortgage deed that he wrote, and he learned how to write in the old hand, which was 200 years prior to the play and or to the incident, and signed it William Shakespeare. And his father was taken in like that, and his father demanded more. And, for example, his father often worried about Shakespeare's religion. He was afraid that he died a papist. And so William Henry created a document obviously written by a Protestant, made his father happy. His father was so happy that he brought in some experts of the day to look at it, and the experts loved it. It was just so many people just saw what they wanted to see in these things and were, you know, jumped on the bandwagon.
But he really went to – it was brilliant, really, how he did it. Talk about, like, you know – you'd think, gee, how can you fake a signature? I mean, you'd think most people would be able to see a fraud. It's supposed to be, what, you know, hundreds of years old or however. But he had a process with the ink and the paper. I mean, it was complicated.
Indeed. He learned it from a bookbinder, and he learned how to make it look like it was hundreds of years old.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, I can do a little scene from it that would show you how he did it. And this involves a couple of folks who helped him. But William Henry was saying, in order to please my father, I began to trace Shakespeare's signatures and to imitate them. I'd seen facsimiles of them. Then I got some ink, and I watered it down, and I wrote on the fly leaf of an Elizabethan book, but it appeared obviously modern. How to capture that brown patina so distinctive of ancient times. So I took it to a bookbinder and pronounced it as my own laughingly. He barely gave it a second glance, as if forgery were common practice. And he said, sir, goodly signature. Yeah, it appears to be from many years back, but the color, sir, it's all wrong. But then one of his journeymen came to the rescue and said, here, sir, here's how you do it. You take these files which you use for marbling the covers of our calf bindings, and you mix them together, and they get all frothy-like, and there's a kind of a fermentation, and there you have that lovely brown you see not in the ink of your modern age. Then he wrote on a scrap of paper. It wasn't legible, and I told him so. Sir, naturally it wouldn't be. That's why you hold your manuscript up to a roaring fire, and the writing darkens as if with the centuries. And there you have it, sir. No one is the wiser.
The Midnight Company presents Rick Kreese's Solemn Mockeries. It's up and running at Tower Grove Abbey through January the 18th, Friday and Saturday evenings. We're talking with Joe Hanrahan, who stars as the main character, and all the other characters, and I guess including the main character, there are 18 altogether.
There's a big number of them. Including
You're not sure?
No, I'm not. I've never really stopped to count. Some of them just have a line or two, but some of them are more prominent. But there's many other characters we talk about, too. But there's an interesting collage of characters there.
Well, from what I understand, it's a very sparse set. I think there is like a chair on one side, maybe a desk or something on the other, and that's about it?
Yes, it is. It takes place in the beautiful Tower Grove Abbey with the stained glass windows in the church setting, and you feel like you're where it's supposed to be. He's making a speaking tour of public gathering places in England, and he's talking to a crowd as if you would just go to see a speaker. So we aren't creating any kind of false background. You're in a public gathering place.
So the kid, if I can call him a kid, starts with a fake signature to please his dad, and it sort of escalates from there, because once his dad believes that, then he goes on to more complicated frauds.
Yeah, and his dad kept he kept getting things, so his dad kept asking for things, and then his dad started wondering, where are these coming from? And so William Henry had to make up a story of some rich man he met in a coffee house that made a gift of these to him with a trunk that held all these things. And his father wanted to see the trunk. He wanted to meet this mysterious man, so William Henry had to distract him by coming up with more and greater treasures, like the manuscript to King Lear.
What do you know about the dad? Was he a smart man? Do you know what he did for a living?
Yes, he was a bookseller and publisher.
Well, you'd think he'd be really in tune with that, then.
It was all he wanted in life was to be able to touch something that Shakespeare had touched, and when it came to him, and it looked so real, and it was the. It looked like a Shakespeare signature, the facsimiles people had seen. He bought off on it. And then as William Henry fed all of his desires, his curiosity about Shakespeare's religion, he wanted a – he was sad because the father was, because there was no information about the courtship of Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway. He wrote love letters and you name it. He produced it.
I guess it shows, as far as where the father was coming from, maybe we're all guilty of this. When you want to believe something – you do?
Yeah. At one point, William Henry says, why didn't anyone notice I was like basically forging on demand? I was like a waiter in a chop house. For you, sir, the mutton, and for you, the manuscript to King Lear.
So it starts with a signature, goes on to love letters and other things, but it sort of climaxes when all of a sudden this new play from Shakespeare nobody ever heard of. So he discovers this new play, which the kid had actually just written himself.
Yeah. It was created, as William Henry says, as we all are, as a result of the frenzied motions of a father. He's being shaken by his father, who's demanding to meet his mysterious benefactor, and he looks on the wall, and there in shaking is a portrait of King Vortigern, an ancient British king this portrait had long hung in his father's study, and that was his idea, and he wrote it. They took it to the Drury Lane, which was run by Richard Brinsley Sheridan, the author of The School for Scandal at the time. He bought it without reading it. John Philip Kemble, the finest tragedian of his age, the actor-manager at the Drury, was going to play the title role. He cast celebrated actresses, Mrs. Siddons, Mrs. Jordan. It was a big cast, but as they got closer and they looked at the script, they started seeing this is all not kosher.
But it was performed.
It was. One night, April Fool's.
Wait a minute.
Yes, April Fool. It was supposed to be performed in December of 1795, before Mr. Ireland's published The Miscellaneous Papers of William Shakespeare, a collection of forgeries, came out, because William Henry did not want people to see that stuff before the play happened. He wanted to be established as a playwright. But it was delayed, and then they pushed it back to April Fool's, and Kemble, knowing what it was, he miscast it. He brought in clowns and other actors with kind of pronounced, almost physical deformities to play roles. He himself did lines like a clown. It was a near theater riot, which was the happened in those
but
days.
But the fact the play was mounted on April Fool's Day, that was just a coincidence?
No, they targeted it there. The theater company did. After a proposed December opening, they said, and it started being delayed, and then they said, no, we're going to do it then.
Is that because they knew it was?
Yes.
Okay, they'd figured it out by then, but they went ahead and produced it anyway.
Yeah, just a one-night thing, and just for fun, and he paired it. There would always be two plays on the bill when they did those, and he paired it with another play about an art collector who deals in forgeries. So
wasn't William Henry embarrassed, disgraced, humiliated?
Yes, but he was hoping for the best, like everyone. He had some big supporters, the Duke of Clarence, who was eventually became the King of England, William IV. He was a supporter because he was dating an actress. And he had the Minister of Parliament, who was a friend of his father's, in the audience. So they all kind of tried to support him, but it just didn't work.
You know, one thing that occurs to me, and we've seen this, I think, in other instances we can think of with people that do really bad things, but a person that is smart enough to do good things But does if he'd only channeled his energy into something positive, who knows what he could have accomplished?
Indeed, yeah. William Henry, you know, continued to write after this, even though he was in exile. He wrote poems and novels and pamphlets. He said his most profitable work was the Life and Times of that celebrated actress, Mrs. Jordan, because the Duke of Clarence paid him not to publish it.
So the focus of the play is, though, this is after the fact, and he's coming back. Your character on stage, you're admitting to what you'd done when you were younger.
Yeah, and explaining why it happened. It had very much to do with his father, but also had to do with his own growing excitement at his own self-worth.
Well, what are the funny parts?
Well, I think it's William Henry's comments on the many many different things that happened. The people, his astute observations, and his sly comments on many things that happened throughout the show. It's a very funny show.
Well, Joe, I would want to mention the director because you've worked with her a number of other times.
Sarah Whitney, she's the associate director for the Midnight Company. This is the seventh show we've done together. Seventh, almost one-person show. Occasionally, we've had another person in there, but yeah, she's brought all of her experience and talent as a stage director to helping tell these one-person stories.
You're sort of known for doing the one-man thing. How many have you done?
Maybe a dozen, 13, 14. I've done a bunch. And it's a matter of convenience. These shows are hard, but they're very convenient to be able to do.
I've done a little acting, and I can't imagine doing a one-man show because if you're up there in an ensemble, if your mind goes blank, which it does, there are people that can save you and point you in the right direction. I would think it's the most horrifying thing in the world to be on stage for an hour or two by yourself.
It's challenging, but it is, it has some great benefits. I mean, as an actor, when you get a monologue or a good speech in a multi-character show, how pleased you are to take the stage and deliver it. And you're able to do that for almost 2 hours in these things.
The Midnight Company presents Rick Crease's Solemn Mockeries. It's up and running now. Through January the 18th, performances are on weekends, Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m. at the Tower Grove Abbey. If you'd like more information, go to stlpublicradio.org to the Cityscape page, and we'll have a link to Midnight Company's website. And what kind of reaction have you been getting?
Very good. The audiences have been smart, literate, and they have reacted loudly with a lot of laughter. It's been good. Good reviews, too.
Solemn Mockeries, Joe Hanrahan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
It's always good to talk to you.
You too.
Coming up next week on Cityscape, we're going to talk with St. Louis artist Zlatko Kosic about his exhibition of video and installation art, Still Adjusting, which is at UMSL's Gallery 210. And in the next installment of Soundbites, produced with Sauce Magazine, we're going to look at the year ahead in food and drink. Join Don Marsh Monday for St. Louis on the Air when he'll talk about the final brief in the For Sake of All study, examining the health and well-being of African Americans in St. Louis and St. Louis County, this time focusing on chronic disease. Then he'll take a look at the practice of rainscaping, landscaping strategies which can make residential lawns more sustainable by preventing runoff. Cityscape is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer with assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Doerr, and Jeremy Bailey. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Cityscape is made possible in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council Estate Agency. Cityscape is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. I'm Steve Potter. Thanks for listening.